law of drug discovery, development, and commercialization. Professor Giacomo, week 14. I want to begin our last class with the chart that we have been using throughout the semester to explore how the various laws that we have been studying map onto the two fundamental economic and technology pathways through which drug, biologics, and devices are discovered, developed, and commercialized. Looking at this chart, we can see that we have explored the following three areas in detail during the past semester. The SEQL area, safety, efficacy, quality, and labeling, where the objective is better products. The area comprising the mechanisms for widening the use of these products, where two principal mechanisms include A, increased funding for buying these products provided from the government's Medicare and Medicaid programs, and B, the marketing rules relating to information to be provided to physicians and patients. And the third area that we have been looking at is the one where two important sets of rights relating to intellectual property need to be reconciled. These two sets being the government-granted right to exclude competitors provided through patents, and the freedom to operate in order to pursue intellectual and commercial objectives. Of course, as we've explored, the mechanism of reconciliation of this right to exclude and freedom to operate is the Drug Price Competition and Patent Restoration Act of 1984, also known as the Hatch-Waxman Act. We have explored the interrelationships between and among these three areas suggested by various commentators in the law review articles that we have been reading. In the chart, these are represented by the red arrows and perpendicular lines. There is one last area on this chart that we need to explore, the one lying square in the middle, the one that references increased R&D spending. It is this area that we will explore in today's class. With the mountain range image of the triple DC pathway in mind, R&D can occur at any point along the pathway, from pre-discovery to market launch to post-launch improvements. Turning to slide 3, we see that there are three principal sources of funding for research and development funding of innovation in drugs, biologics, and devices: government programs, venture capital and capital markets, and sponsorships and collaborations. Government programs consist of funding research and development and a regime by which government-funded innovation can be commercialized by industry. An important recipient of government funding of research and development to support the creation of innovative drugs, biologics, and devices has been the National Institutes of Health, which conducts its own research and also provides grants to academic institutions and others. Prior to 1980, there were questions as to how inventions created by the NIH or by NIH-funded laboratories, mostly at academic institutions, could license these innovations to industry for commercial exploitation. These questions were addressed in the Bayh-Dole Act of 1980, which we will review in detail in a moment. Funds from venture capitalists in the capital markets fall into two broad categories: private offerings of securities that are not registered with securities regulators, such as the SEC here in the U.S., and public offerings of securities that are so registered. In the United States, the federal regulator with which securities offerings are registered is the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission. venture capital finance is largely accomplished through private offerings of investments in equity securities, typically preferred stock, that is convertible into common stock upon the occurrence of certain conditions, such as an initial public offering. It is rare for preferred stock purchased in a venture capital deal to be traded like the equity or debt securities that are listed on securities exchanges or nonetheless traded between financial institutions. Capital markets transactions comprise a mix of both private and public offerings of both equity and debt securities. The term capital markets describes the system, or I at least use that term, to describe the system by which securities are first issued with the help of investment bankers and then subsequently traded by traders on equity and debt trading desks. The third source of funding, shown on slide 3, for research and development of innovative healthcare products, comes from non-government sponsorships and collaborations by, between, and among not-for-profit and for-profit organizations. I use the phrase non-governmental sponsorship collaborations broadly to encompass a range of transactions stretching from simple one-way funding grants to complex shared funding and development arrangements. Historically, not-for-profit foundations, for example, the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, has provided substantial funding to not-for-profit academic institutions for life science research. Through this type of funding, HHMI, as the Howard Hughes Medical Institute is often called, has become one of the largest virtual research organizations in the world. Similarly, for-profit corporations also provide R&D funding to academic institutions, both for specific and non-specific programs. Over the course of my career, I've worked on several of these. Indeed, over the past 30 years, there has been an increasing reliance on R&D collaborations between and among various types of enterprises, not-for-profit and for-profit. A good example of collaboration between and among for-profit enterprises is the development of the diagnostic used to determine overexpression of the HER2 gene in breast cancer patients, the condition that must be present, according to the label, for the drug Herceptin. Let me restate that a good example of collaboration between for-profit enterprises is the development of the diagnostic used to determine overexpression of the HER2 gene in breast cancer patients, the condition that must be present for the patient to be prescribed the drug Herceptin. You can see this in the label for this drug. And indeed, you should go back to the slide that we looked at near the beginning of the semester to review all of the collaborations at work in the case of Herceptin. It really is a model for collaboration within the life science industry. Finally, the last point to be made about slide number 3 is that in the last 5 to 10 years, there has been a blossoming of the so-called public-private partnership. In this arrangement, an array of not-for-profit organizations and for-profit enterprises collaborate on tackling a major health problem, actually on one or more major health problems. The best examples of these are the efforts of the pharmaceutical industry working with nations in Africa to battle HIV and also As a further example, the programs that the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has been pursuing to conquer HIV, tuberculosis, malaria, and about 8 other major disease and health problems around the world. With that said, about the overarching outline of ways to increase R&D funding, let's turn to slide 4, where what is presented are the sources of finance for life science and healthcare product research and development on the DDC pathway map. Each of the three major sources of finance appears on the left-hand side of the slide and is associated with the span of the DDC pathway map with which it is most closely associated. Along the right-hand side of the slide, each of the U.S. federal government organizations responsible for these spans are similarly set forth. Note the overlapping of these associations represented by the overlapping curved braces, particularly among the government agencies. These overlaps are addressed in the Carnahan article that we read a couple of weeks ago. Regarding these overlaps, note on slide 5 the attempt at HHS back in 2004 to bring the NIH, FDA, CMS, and CDC together in a task force to focus on ways in which HHS could stimulate medical technology innovation. My understanding is that much not was done by this task force that is addressed in slide 5. Perhaps various provisions in FDA of 2007 aimed at this vital subject, for example, the provisions in FDA relating to the Reagan-Udall Foundation, will provide some stimulation here. Slide 6 turns to the road that led to the passage in 1980 of the Bayh-Dole Act, which is the legislation we'll spend a few minutes focusing on now. The graph in slide 6 illustrates the percentage change in U.S. GDP for the period from 1930 through 2005. Observe the so-called go-go era of the 1960s, when year-to-year real growth for most of the decade hovered around 5%. Notwithstanding some very dark political and social moments during the 60s, the Cuban Missile Crisis, the assassination of two Kennedys and Martin Luther King, the beginning of U.S. escalation in Vietnam, and the chaos at the 1968 Democratic National Convention, at least economically, the U.S. was on a decade-long, consistently paced marathon during the 1960s. On slide 7, I have listed a good source for U.S. economic data, the website of the branch of the U.S. Federal Reserve centered in Minneapolis. Note the reference in the text on this slide to the Beige Book. This is an often cited resource for U.S. economic data and one that you should familiarize yourselves with, because you will hear, no matter what profession you enter as a lawyer, you will hear about the Beige Book continually. Now, back on slide 6, if you look at the real GDP percentage changes in the 1970s, you see a remarkable difference in the 1970s compared to the 1960s. The 70s was a time of boom and bust, with significant busts coming in 1970, a prolonged period from 1973 to 1975, and 1980. The decade of the 1970s was plagued also by inflation. In August 1971, for example, the Nixon administration imposed wage price controls, an unheard-of thing for an economy based on the principles of free enterprise. By 1979, annual inflation in consumer prices hit the 13.3% mark, the highest experienced in 33 years at that point. And by the close of 1980, the prime rate was at 20.35%. 20.35%. Compare that to where we are today. The combination of stagnation in economic growth and inflation in prices and wages became known as stagflation. The 1970s also marked the entrance onto the world stage of the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries. In 1973, OPEC embargoed all oil shipments to the U.S., Western Europe, and Japan. In the 35 years since that time, it has been very hard to forget the long lines that formed every day at gasoline stations and the kind of planning that you needed to undertake in order to get in a car for the purpose of traveling any distance. Against this economic backdrop of the 1970s and the energy crisis of that time, all sorts of attempts were made all over the federal government to spur innovation in energy technology. This bewildering array is illustrated on slide 8. The underlying principle here is that, generally speaking, technological innovation can lead to reduced dependency on scarce resources and spur economic growth through increased productivity and production. In this light, as described on slide 9, President Carter in 1978 created an advisory committee of about 150 senior representatives from industry, the public sector, labor, science, and academia to undertake a major policy review of industrial innovation. The task force was chaired by the Secretary of Commerce. In 1979, the task force issued a 300-page report that included findings relative to the patent system. Two of these are highlighted on this slide, slide 9. The adoption of a policy for promoting industrial innovation through patented inventions created with government funding, and the creation of a single court of appeals for hearing patent cases. Thus was conceived the legislative process that culminated in the enactment of the Bayh-Dole Act of 1980 and the creation of the Court of Appeals for the Federal Circuit. Slide 10 is a screenshot from the West system for PL 96517, the Bayh-Dole Act, with cites to the legislative history underlying this act. This is a really useful tool that's available to you through Westlaw that you really should make use of in all of your courses during law school and after. Slide 11 summarizes the primary needs for the Bayh-Dole Act as set forth in the legislative history, and which we reviewed a couple of slides ago. Slide 12 contains excerpts from the House report on the bill. Note in these excerpts the reference to the oil supply crisis and the, to use the term again, which appears in the legislative history, the bewildering array of 26 different agency regulations on commercial rights to use the inventions arising from government-funded research. Slide 13 presents the major statutory points in H.R. 6933, the bill originally initiated in the House of Representatives that became the Bayh-Dole Act. First, as indicated on this slide, the Act provided a system of re-examining patents whose validity had been challenged in order to strengthen investor confidence in those patents. Think back to our class on patents where one of the, or many of the cases that we looked at involved challenges to the validity of the patent. So the first thing that Baidu did here was to create a system of re-examining patents so that lingering doubts about the validity of patents could be re-examined outside the context of very expensive litigation. The second major point on slide 13 associated with Baidu was an increase in the patent office's budget and a change in the fee structure charged to applicants and patentees. This should remind you of the PDUFA scheme for review of drug and biologics applications at the FDA. The third point made by Baidu, or made in Baidu, was the creation of a single uniform national policy for licensing to industry the inventions arising from government-funded research. And it is the last of these three points that we want to now focus on. This system, this regime for licensing government-funded inventions or inventions arising from government-funded research was viewed as being especially helpful to universities and small businesses with respect to their desire to license inventions that they had created under government contracts for further exploitation and commercialization. And again, it's this third element of the Baidu Act to which we now turn. The 12 sections, and I'm now on slide 14, the 12 sections comprising H.R. 6933 are set forth on slide 14. The patent policy is covered in section 6 and is appropriately titled Government Patent Policy. Turning to slide 15, we see that section 6 of the Baidu Act added a new chapter, chapter 38, to title 35 of the U.S. Code. Remember that it is title 35 of the U.S. Code that addresses patents. Chapter 38, as originally enacted here in section 6 of the Baidu Act, comprise 12 sections, which are listed here on slide 15. Several of these sections are excerpted on slides 16 through 23. I will leave you to read the details here, but we'll pause on a few items. First, on slide 17, note the definition of subject invention. This is the term used to describe the invention arising from government-funded research, and that is subject to the Act. We next pause on slide 19 to read section 202A. This action sets forth the basic statutory right of a non-profit organization, such as a university or small business, to retain title to subject inventions. In return for this right, the Baidu regime also imposes certain requirements and limitations. For example, as excerpted on slide 21 and slide 22, section 203 gives the government the right to march in. March-in rights give the government the authority to grant licenses to subject inventions to third parties in cases where the original contractor, assignee, or exclusive licensee of a subject invention has not granted such licenses, and the government reasonably determines under the circumstances that on one or more public policy grounds enumerated in Section 203, that the subject invention should be so licensed to third parties. Marchand rights are always cited as risk factors by companies that are licensors and licensees of subject inventions when they are seeking investment from investors or reporting to investors. Marchand rights are also, if you look carefully, seen on the front page of patent applications and issued patents. In this respect, it is important to note that third parties have the right to petition the government to exercise these marchand rights. This notwithstanding, at least in the case of subject inventions in the field of drugs, biologics, and devices, in the 28 years of history under Bayh-Dole, while no government marchand has ever been completed, to my knowledge, nonetheless, there have been a small number of attempts by third parties to petition the government to exercise these marchand rights. One example of this is illustrated on slides 23 and 24. Excuse me, slides 24 and 25 in the case of the product Norvir for treating patients suffering from HIV infections. As set forth on slide 25, the NIH concluded that marchand was not warranted here. I will leave you to read the letter from the NIH excerpted on these two slides, slides 24 and 25, in which the NIH set forth this conclusion. As we will see in a moment, licensing of subject inventions under Bayh-Dole has been extensive. Based on the first 20 years of experience under Bayh-Dole, the 106th Congress in 2000 deemed it necessary to enact several improvements to the Act. These improvements comprised the Technology Transfer Commercialization Act of 2000. Section 2 of this Act is set forth on slide 26, and it is worth mentioning the findings that are set forth here that form the basic reasons for these improvements. First, Bayh-Dole focuses on linking what Congress called an unparalleled network of over 700 federal laboratories and U.S. universities for the purpose of obtaining the, quote, great promise for our future economic prosperity, close quote. Second, Bayh-Dole, as originally enacted, marked a landmark change. Third, Congress demonstrated 20 years of commitment, as of 2000, to the principles of Bayh-Dole. Fourth, the type of technology transfer activities fostered by Bayh-Dole in respect of government-funded inventions have strengthened the global competitiveness of the U.S. Fifth, the technology transfer process must be made industry-friendly in order to incent companies to invest time and capital to innovate. And sixth, the Bayh-Dole regime needs to balance the public policy needs of adequately protecting the rights of the public to inventions discovered or created with government funding, encouraging companies to further develop government-funded inventions, read the word develop here as including the concept of commercialization, and finally making the whole regime more consistent and simple. This sixth finding raises an interesting point. It is shorthand for the fact that since its introduction in Congress 3 decades ago, there has not been unanimous support of the premise in Bayh-Dole. This premise is that government-funded inventions
can be exploited by for-profit companies. The nature of the argument against Baidu, are illustrated in slide 27. This slide contains excerpts from the remarks of Representative Jack Brooks that appear in the legislative history of H.R. 6933, the bill that became the Baidu Act. Brooks took issue with the logic that allowing for-profit companies to exploit government-funded inventions would spur economic growth. He argued that at the time of the bill's passage, the U.S. federal government was already spending $30 billion annually on research and development, and that giving universities and companies the right to own the fruits of this government-funded research and development was a further investment by the federal government and a giveaway of rights that properly belong to the people. I'll pause a moment here just so that you can read Brooks' argument and see if you agree with him. Returning on slides 28 through 31, let me restate that. Returning to the 2000 Baidu Improvements Act, slides 28 through 31 summarize for you in tabular form the amendments to the original 1980 Act. You should review these offline to get a sense of the improvements. As we saw a few minutes ago, the original impetus for Baidu was the need to create innovative sources of energy arising from the experience of the 1970s. In this respect, our experience with Baidu exemplifies the law of unintended consequences, as the field where Baidu has probably had the greatest impact is not energy, but the discovery and development of new molecular entities for healthcare. Again, not energy independence. Remember here how throughout the course this semester we have been looking at NMEs, new molecular entities. The statistics presented on slide 32 illustrate this point. I should say slides 32 through 35. The statistics on these slides are from the Association of University Technology Managers. This organization comprises the officers and staff at universities throughout the United States responsible for managing the licensing of inventions created at those universities. In working on technology licenses to university-created inventions, I have myself often negotiated with these individuals and their counsel. Each year, AUTUM, as it's called, conducts a licensing survey of the academic institutions represented by its members. In the 2004 survey, as set forth on slide 32, AUTUM noted that since 1980, U.S. universities, hospitals, and research institutes have spun out 4,543 companies, based on licenses from these academic institutions, with two-thirds of these companies, as of 2004, still operating. AUTUM concluded that this survival rate demonstrates the successful application of these government-funded technologies at universities in the market. You can argue, and let me back up, I just said how AUTUM concluded that the survival rate demonstrates the successful application of these government, of the conversion of these government-funded inventions into marketplace technologies. That's a little bit unfair. AUTUM's comment really doesn't include the word government-funded invention, but certainly many of them were. you can argue over Autumn's statistics and whether they illustrate a conversion into new molecular entities and improvements in safety, efficacy, quality, and affordability of innovative healthcare products. You can argue whether these statistics show that government-funded inventions get converted into NMEs and better healthcare products. But supporters of Bayh-Dole would argue that without Bayh-Dole, it is very questionable whether these statistics would have or could have been achieved. Slide 33 presents data on the sources of research funding for U.S. universities, hospitals, and research institutes for the period 1991 through 2004. The data shows that the total of such funds grew from about $12.5 billion in 1991 to about $41 billion in 2004. Of this total, the largest portion derives from the federal government, with this source growing from about $9 billion in 1991 to about $28 billion in 2004. Representing a decline in this source's percentage of the total from about 75% in 1991 to about 68% in 2004. It would be interesting to see if this trend continued over the last 4 years or so, but it's an interesting aspect of the data here. Industrial sources, as shown on the slide, in the graph on slide 33, grew from about $1 billion in 1991 to about $3 billion in 2004, representing about 8% in 1991 and about 7.3% in 2004. So as a percentage of the total, industry funding for research expenditures by U.S. universities, hospitals, and research institutes really didn't change over the 13 years that we're looking at here, 13 or 14 years that we're looking at here. So the obvious question that this chart presents is what source or sources account for the gap between the sum of federal and industrial funding and the total? In 1991, this gap was about 17% of the total, and in 2004, it's one-fourth of the total. I suspect that the answer here is a combination of private sources and endowments. It's an interesting growing gap that would be good to further explore, but we won't do so here. Slide 34, continuing with Autumn's statistics, shows that income to the organizations represented by Autumn's membership from licensing of inventions created by them, and again, many of them are probably funded with federal funds, as we just saw on the previous slide, that the income from these inventions grew from about $200 million in 1991 to about $1.45 billion in 2004, with the largest portion represented by royalties from licensing of the technologies, indicating at least some commercial success, so there may be some evidence there for NMEs being created. And also note the growing portion in these revenues of a category that Autumn refers to as all other types. It would be, given the importance of all other types, as we see in the chart, it would be interesting to further explore what Autumn means by this term, all other types. So, again, if you look at the data in 34 and in 35, which we'll turn to in a second, you have some basis, maybe some basis for arguing that Bayh-Dole is creating NMEs. Slide 35, which we'll now turn to, shows the growth in invention disclosures, which is a measure of inventive activity. From 1991 through 2004, the number of invention disclosures for the reporting organizations in Audum, or represented by the members of Audum, grew from a little over 6,000 reported by 111 organizations to almost 16,900 by 198 organizations over that period. So this represents an almost 78% increase in the number of organizations and a 54% increase in the average number of invention disclosures per organization, where this average number grew from about 55 in 1991 to over 85 in 2004, based on my calculations. I think it would be interesting to look at the distribution of these invention disclosures on an institution by institution basis to see if the growth has been even across all institutions. I suspect that it has not been. Slides 36 through 39 contain an example of the form agreement used by the Public Health Service to license inventions that its employees create. I include this form for your own review outside of class to get a sense of the content of such licenses. The only thing that I would pause on is on slide 37, just to show you the connections between the various segments of the course. If you look at section 3.1 on slide 37, you see that the license granted is the license to make and have made, to use and have used, to sell and have sold, to offer to sell and import any licensed products, which is a defined term. Well, where does this phrase, to make, to use, to sell, to offer to sell, to import, where does that come from? And if you go back to the patent law that we studied, you'll see that phrase comes right out of section 271 in the patent statute regarding acts of infringement, what constitutes an act of infringement. So you can see how an understanding of the law of patents relates to the practice of writing licenses regarding patented inventions. So I just wanted to pause there and note that. Also, on slide 37, you can see that often it is the case in government contracts that the government reserves certain research rights, which you see in Section 5. So, with that said, I want to look at one more topic in this last in the remaining moments of this hour. I want to look at a controversy from about 11 years ago that exemplifies the sort of issues that can arise under Bayh-Dole and about which counsel engaged in licensing transactions involving subject inventions under Bayh-Dole should be aware. It involves a settlement agreement between the Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston, a teaching center for Harvard Medical School, and Decode Genetics, a biopharmaceutical company based in Iceland that is dedicated to developing products to improve the treatment, diagnosis, and prevention of common diseases. Decode combines its expertise in modern genetics with its access to the extensive genealogical database that Iceland has compiled over the centuries since it was first settled by Vikings from Scandinavia. here in the United States, an analog of this kind of genealogical database is the one maintained in Utah by the large community of Mormons who settled in Utah back in the 19th century. So, coming back to DECODE and Beth Israel Deaconess, DECODE was formed in 1997 by Dr. Carrie Stephenson, who has been the president and CEO of the company since its founding. Dr. Stephenson himself is a tall, lean, striking individual who traces his lineage all the way back to the Viking founders of Iceland, and he himself is an Icelander. That's where he was educated before coming to the United States, I guess, in the early 80s. From 83 to about 93, he was at the University of Chicago, and for about 4 years, 5 years, from 1993 until April 1997, he was a professor of neurology, neuropathology, and neuroscience at Harvard. And from 1993 through December 1996, he was director of neuropathology at Beth Israel Hospital. While he was at Beth Israel, Dr. Stephenson had conducted research that led to the creation of technology associated with the linkage of a particular segment of DNA to a trait exhibited by patients suffering from multiple sclerosis. At DECODE, Dr. Stephenson intended to pursue further development of this technology. This was well known and publicized. It was no secret. And Beth Israel, thinking about its obligations not only to itself, but also obligations to the federal government, because certainly much of the work here was funded by the federal government, by the NIH, with that kind of responsibility, Beth Israel asserted that it had ownership rights in the technology because at least part of the technology had been created while Dr. Stephenson was employed at Beth Israel using its facilities for conducting the relevant research. Rather than engaging in a long, ugly courtroom battle, especially which would have been especially damaging because there was an ongoing relationship between Dr. Stephenson and Beth Israel, certainly many of its researchers there, DECODE and Beth Israel settled the dispute at the end of 1997. The settlement of the dispute took the form of a settlement agreement, which is excerpted in slides 40 and 41. Turning to these slides, it's interesting to note that the principal components of the settlement agreement included the following. First, it provided for joint ownership of the technology. And Beth Israel granted to DECODE under its joint ownership interest and exclusive license to develop and commercialize therapeutic and diagnostic products worldwide based on Beth Israel's interest in the relevant patents and know-how. In return for this license, DECODE became obligated through the settlement agreement to pay license fees and other payments upon the achievement of established milestones leading to the discovery of products based on this technology, and provisions which required DECODE to pay royalties to Beth Israel on royalty-bearing products defined in the settlement agreement that could result from the licensed technology. So I offer you this anecdote of this settlement agreement between an NIH-funded institution and a private corporation. I offer you this anecdote to illustrate a very simple rule that you must follow when you're engaged in this kind of work as counsel. And that rule is that you must, as counsel, counsel your client, advise your client to conduct thorough due diligence when entering into transactions of this sort. With that said, let's take a short break and return for the last hour of the semester. So, beginning hour number two of our last class, at the outset of this last hour, I need for a moment to go all the way back to our first hour of class at the beginning of the semester. If you remember, during that hour, I noted that one of the lessons that we would learn over the course of the semester was a general rule in legal analysis that the same word in a statute, in a contract, in a court decision, the same word can have significantly different meanings for different parties, and that this general rule very much applies to the law of drug discovery, development, and commercialization. If you remember, I attributed that expression of this rule on that slide back in class number one to Arthur Miller, the civil procedure scholar and one-time Harvard Law professor who is now at NYU. In this hour, I think we will see one more time how this general rule applies in the context of disclosure documents related to investment in companies engaged in the discovery, development, and commercialization of drugs, biologics, and devices, particularly with respect to reporting of clinical trial results either to the FDA or to the capital markets. This brings us back to slide three at the top of the last hour. In that slide, we noted that an important source of R&D funding in life science is venture capital and capital markets, and the capital markets. We will focus on these two sources of life science R&D funding in this last hour. In doing so, we will come back to a central theme that has been traveling with us the entire semester. That was oftentimes in the clear open, and many times just under the surface. And this central theme is the importance of information to government regulation of the DDC pathway. To begin, I want to turn to the photographs on slide 42. These photographs were taken about 2 years ago at the Mission Bay campus of the University of California in San Francisco, UCSF, as it is called. The UCSF Mission Bay campus is being developed as a biopharmaceutical research center for the 21st century. The left-hand photograph on slide 42 is a directory stone that points in the direction of three buildings at Mission Bay. Genentech Hall, which is this beautiful building pictured in the upper right-hand portion of slide 42. Byers Hall, which is pictured in the lower right-hand portion of the slide and which stands adjacent to Genentech Hall. And Rock Hall, which is not pictured. It's in the, as the arrows show you on the directory stone, it's in the opposite direction. Genentech is perhaps one of the greatest testimonies in life science, more particularly biotechnology in its classic sense, to the power of venture capital. Genentech's primary venture capital firm back in the 1970s when it was formed and through a good portion of the 1980s was the now legendary Kleiner Perkins Caulfield and Byers. Before the current financial crisis, I would often say that as Goldman Sachs is to investment banking, Kleiner Perkins is to venture capital. Given what is happening in the world today with respect to the financial crisis, I don't know if I'm going to be able to continue to say that. But nonetheless, historically, I think that analogy has held. The hall pictured in the lower right-hand corner of the photograph on slide 42, or of the photographs on slide 42, is named after Brooke Byers, the Byers in the Kleiner Perkins shingle. Rock Hall, the hall not pictured on this slide, is named after Arthur Rock, a legendary venture capitalist. I like to remind people that the drugs and biologics that we will all be taking 20 years from now are being discovered and created today in buildings like these two that are pictured on this slide. To place venture capital in the context of the Triple DC pathway, remember the mountain range slide that we have looked at throughout the course and that appears on slide 4 of this slide deck. You can see from slide 4, let me give you a moment to go back to it. You can see from slide 4 that venture capital as a funding source comes onto the scene at about the time of discovery symbolized in the lower right-hand corner of the pathway chart. Of course, as preparatory and due diligence matters, the venture capital community is continually studying the universe of scientific research that leads to company-forming discoveries and inventions. Now, turning all the way back to slide 43, I'll pause to give you a moment to do that. Turning back to slide 43, we see a representation of the manner in which our newly formed company that formed in the lower right-hand part of the mountain range map of the Triple DC pathway, that this newly formed company is as we see on slide 43, is funded with seed funding and venture capital at its beginning point. At the formation of the company, a small amount of capital is invested in the common stock of the company by so-called seed stage or angel investors. This amount of seed funding can range anywhere from about $250,000 to $1 million. And it is with this initial seed funding as walking around money that the company engages in efforts to bring in the first of what will probably be several rounds of venture capital, with these rounds generally ranging from about $3 million to $7 million for initial rounds to as much as tens of millions for later rounds. In early rounds of venture capital, there may be 3 to 5 venture capital funds as investors, with the group being led by one of them. In later rounds, this initial group can expand to as many as 6 to 10 venture capital funds and other investors, such as large technology-oriented operating companies and pension and retirement savings funds. We'll say more about these operating companies as venture capital investors in a moment. The form of the investment by the venture capital fund, pictured in the middle of the chart on slide 43, is serial preferred convertible stock. This is in contrast to the common stock that the seed and angel investors receive. So let's focus on what this term of art means, serial preferred convertible stock. We say serial because, as we just noted, there can be a series of venture capital rounds. Usually each of these series is lettered, and the lettering obviously begins with the letter A and can go forth from there. We say preferred because the stock purchased by the venture capital fund usually has superior rights to the common stock, but it is still equity. And we say convertible because the stock purchased by venture capital funds is usually convertible into the common stock of the company. This conversion can occur at the option of the investor or upon certain events where the company can force the preferred stock to be converted into common stock. Usually these events include an initial public offering that provides a certain amount of capital at a certain threshold price per share, or a takeover of our company by a larger company or similarly situated company. The venture capital fund is usually established as a limited partnership that is managed by a venture capital management company, and that's what we illustrate here on slide 43. Kleiner Perkins Caulfield and Byers is an example of a venture capital fund manager, and it manages several limited partnerships, each with a specified maximum level of funds. As each fund becomes fully invested, a successful venture capital management company begins raising capital for its next fund. Funds can be specialized by the type of industry in which they invest. For example, Al Gord, who is now at Kleiner Perkins, is helping to manage a fund investing in green technology. And many funds are oriented toward biotechnology or healthcare or life science. That's fairly typical. And there are funds that focus on information technology and electronics, software, things of that sort. Just note for a moment that a fund that can consist of anywhere from $100 million to $900 million, obviously it takes time to fully invest those funds. It can take a number of years. The limited partnership interests, as suggested on slide 43, are typically sold to investors of substantial means in private placements under Regulation D under the Securities Act of 1933. Regulation D is a regulation promulgated by the SEC to allow private placements to more readily take place. Traditionally, the investors in Reg D deals are wealthy individuals and families, and also pensioned and retirement savings funds, venture capital funds, and I misspoke. Reg D, what I should have said is that Reg D covers the sale of limited partnership interests to investors, and it also covers the sale of the serial convertible preferred stock to the VC fund itself. Now, in addition to venture capital funds with these types of investors and managers, there are also venture capital funds established by technology-oriented companies. A great example is Intel's venture capital unit. In the life sciences, several of the large pharmaceutical and biopharmaceutical companies have venture capital units and business development units that are responsible for venture capital type investments. We will see in a moment that one of Genentech's venture capital stage investors back in the 1980s was the pharmaceutical company Roche. As illustrated in slide 43, in the first half of 2007, corporate venture capital accounted for about 9% of the total dollars invested in U.S.-based venture capital deals, representing about one-fifth of the total number of venture capital deals in that period. I suspect that since that time, in the last year or so, the corporate venture capitalists have either held this position or increased its importance. While slide 43 addresses the venture capital investment stage, slide 44 addresses the venture capital exit stage. What do I mean by exit? Well, an exit can be an initial public offering or an acquisition of the company by another company. This exit is illustrated in slide 44, and in the next slide we'll look at an interesting manifestation of the phenomenon of corporate venture capital investing. But first, let's review the financial dynamics of exit stage. If an initial public offering satisfying the preset conditions of total proceeds and price per share occurs, then the serial preferred convertible stock automatically converts into the common stock. Typically, the venture capital fund would sell these common shares for substantially more cash than it originally invested in the company, and then distribute that cash to the limited partners. Again, when all of this is working properly, the limited partner is receiving substantially more cash than it originally invested. Sometimes the venture capital fund will distribute to the limited partners the common shares obtained from the conversion of the preferred, and the limited partner then makes the decision whether to hold the shares or sell them. As an alternative to the IPO, there is also the exit defined by the sale or merger of the company to or with another company. This type of exit event also leads to an automatic conversion of the preferred stock into common stock if certain preset conditions are met. If the sale is for cash, the venture capital fund receives cash for the common stock arising from the conversion of the preferred stock and distributes the cash to the limited partners, just as we saw in the case of an IPO. If the sale is for securities of the purchaser or the entity into which the company is merged, then those securities may be sold by the venture fund with the resulting cash distributed to the limited partners in the fund, or those securities may be distributed to the limited partners who then continue to hold or sell them. Turning to slide 45, this slide contains an interesting quote with a reference to Tom Perkins. This is the same Perkins whose name appears in the Kleiner Perkins shingle. He is a very, very interesting individual, and we won't go into that during class, but I urge you to do some research on Tom Perkins. He's a fascinating fellow. Coming back to this quote, which is relevant to us, we go back to the mid-1980s, a time in Genentech's history when its early success required substantially greater capital than it then had to take it to the next level. The only way to do justice to this quote is to read it aloud. So forgive me while I do that, and you can follow along. Quote, "With the investors looking for liquidity, Tom Perkins was pushing the notion of selling the company to Big Pharma, who really had the resources, had the people, had the development capability to take this exciting technology and commercialize it. With a little firm like Genentech, with fairly novice management," parenthetically, I don't think you can say that today, with fairly novice management who had never developed a pharmaceutical product, again, you can't say that today, who had never developed a pharmaceutical product before, without the big money, you would need to do a clinical and development program. Maybe the way to go was to sell the company. Forgive me for those parenthetical comments in there, but this is just an absolutely wonderful quote. It harbingers the fact, which you all may know, that Roche came along shortly after Perkins made this comment and purchased a majority stake in Genentech. Recognizing Genentech's unique strengths, Roche allowed the company significant operating independence over the years. And this is as seen in the drug Herceptin, which we looked at the very first week of class. We see that this independence afforded to Genentech worked. If we roll the clock forward to the last few months, we see that with a 56% ownership stake in Genentech, Roche announced, again a few months ago, a tender offer for all of the shares in Genentech that it does not own. This exemplifies the trend that has developed over the last year or so for large pharmaceutical companies to acquire biopharmaceutical and biotechnology companies. The reasons for this are largely related to a topic that we have continually looked at during this semester and during this class, the importance of new molecular entities. The large pharmaceutical companies see the biopharma and biotech companies as a significant source of NMEs to replenish their product pipelines as patents on so-called blockbuster drugs expire, and new biotechnology-based discovery and development tools are proving to result in a new breed of safer and more effective drugs and biologics. So just as the financial world has undergone this tremendous metamorphosis in an incredibly short period of time, so too is this metamorphosis occurring in the biotechnology industry, but perhaps for different reasons. One thing to note, though, is that notwithstanding this trend, if you think of the DDC pathway map, my own sense is that you will continue to see the emergence of companies that are based on inventions funded at universities and subject to the Bayh-Dole Act. Slide 46 illustrates the principle that faced with spending funds on scientists and engineers or lawyers, and all other things being equal, venture financiers will always prefer to spend their scarce resources on scientists and engineers, not lawyers. So, and this should be obvious, the reasons for that penchant for spending should be obvious. With that said, it clearly is to the advantage of the entire venture capital community and both the managers, the funds, and the investors and the companies in which venture capital is invested, is to all of those stakeholders' advantage to reduce the transaction cost of doing a venture capital deal as much as possible, and creating a field of settled expectations with respect to the documents that are used for venture capital investing. So with that in mind, the National Venture Capital Association has sponsored the creation of a set of model transaction documents, and these are listed on slide 46. This is a wonderful set of annotated documents that you should download and study and be aware of their existence. This is just a wonderful resource, and I place it here not because we'll go through each of these documents, but because I want you to know that they're here and they're a tremendous resource. Slide 47, which is a very complex slide as you look at it, brings us into the world of capital markets finance and its intersection with the DDC pathway and also FDA regulation. And we'll see what prompted me to generate this awful-looking slide in a moment. But staying with me for a second. Along the x-axis in this slide, you see the array of documents that we have been exploring in the context of FDA regulation. While along the y-axis, you see the array of documents that characterize the capital markets world and that relate to regulation by the Securities and Exchange Commission. The FDA documents include pre-IND notes for meetings with FDA officials, INDs, NDAs, including labeling, safety reports, and third-party reports in the scientific and medical literature. Reports in JAMA and in the New England Journal of Medicine, in the British Journal Lancet, and the like. The capital markets documents that are along that y-axis include private placement memos for private placements, press releases, prospectuses, periodic reports like Form 10-Q, filings for quarterly reports and Form 10-K filings for annual reports, current reports on Form 8-K to report significant events that need to be disclosed to the capital markets as quickly as possible under the circumstances and that cannot wait for a quarterly or annual report, and third-party reports. For example, third-party reports from security analysts at financial institutions. The third axis here, the z-axis in this graph, represents the waypoints along the TCCC pathway: discovery, non-clinical studies, clinical studies, and post-market approval studies. The straight red line in the plane formed by the x and z-axis represent the historic, generally linear path followed by FDA-related safety, efficacy, quality, and labeling documents. The linearity of this path may be changing in order to promote more innovation and creation of NMEs. The nonlinear green curve in the plane formed by the Y and Z axes represent the historically generally nonlinear path followed by SEC-related capital markets documents. Creating a curve that represents the cross of the red and green paths, like we did that spiral way back in week number one to reflect the evolution of informatics over the last 50 years or so. The cross of this red line and green line is much too complex for me to try and draw here, and I'll lead you to imagine such a cross, and the complexity of creating that cross really helps to illustrate the complexity of managing these two great bodies of disclosure, which we'll see in a moment can, if not done correctly, lead to very significant and damaging litigation. With that said, let's turn to a much simpler model that compares the FDA and SEC, and this is in slide 48. This slide compares the FDA in terms of the types of documents upon which it focuses and its central mission with the type of documents upon which the SEC relies and its central mission. Using this structure, we see that the FDA focuses on study reports, product labels, and safety event reports for the purpose of drug safety management, and that the SEC focuses on disclosure documents of the sort delineated in the prior slide for the purpose of managing the integrity of the financial markets. Each of the FDA and SEC uses a different algebraic-like formula for accomplishing its specific information management task for the purpose of achieving its specific mission. This is illustrated on slide 49. The FDA is tied to the central drug safety limit theorem that we looked at earlier in the course and that plays an important role in understanding FDA of 2007 and the federal preemption issue presented in Wyeth v. Levine. A corollary of this theorem is that because a drug is deemed to be safe does not suggest an absence of risk. The SEC, on the other hand, is governed by the algebra of financial materiality. The equation here is driven by the principle that the information that needs to be disclosed to prospective and existing investors is the information that a reasonable person would want for making an investment decision. And again, an investment decision can be either the decision to buy or the decision to sell. As illustrated at the bottom of slide 49, in the case of reporting the results of clinical trials, there has traditionally been a difference in application of the FDA's central drug safety limit theorem and the SEC's financial materiality theorem. While I think the situation with several drugs being withdrawn from the market in the first part of this decade may have changed this inverse relationship suggested on slide 49, I think a large part of it still remains in effect. to look at this further, in the case of the FDA and its focus on protecting the safety of human subjects, whether it is a phase 1, phase 2, or phase 3 trial, or post-approval study, the aspects of human safety are always present in full force. Full disclosure to the FDA of adverse events associated with the use of a drug, biologic, or a device is an unwaverable rule without regard to the number of patients or subjects involved. In the case of the SEC and capital markets-oriented documents, however, in the absence of a failed product that may create state tort law liability, whether the failure of a given clinical trial to show safety or efficacy needs to be reported by a given company has historically been a function of the breadth and depth of the sponsor's pipeline and size. As indicated on slide 49, a phase 1 clinical trial failure that otherwise doesn't expose a big pharmaceutical company to tort liability is a small biotech's financial disaster. And as a result, materiality of a clinical trial failure, the materiality of that failure varies depending upon the company in which it occurred. This is really different from the requirement to report adverse events in clinical trials to the FDA. It doesn't matter whether you're big, small, medium, that reporting requirement is there with the FDA. Moving to slide 50, we see a more graphic illustration of the model we looked at back on slide 48. In this slide, around the part of the triple-DC pathway from discovery to the launch of a drug, biologic, or device, and the medical care provided with that product following launch, each of the FDA and SEC have their antenna tuned to different frequencies. The SEC's antenna are these green loops around the drug discovery to launch and medical care continuum, and the red loops represent the FDA's antenna. Now, the SEC is using this antenna to gauge capital markets disclosures, while the FDA is gauging is using this antenna to gauge the information and disclosures about safety and efficacy for healthcare market purposes. So the antenna are tuned, really, of each of these regulators is tuned to different frequencies. Historically, as illustrated in this slide, these two different sets of antenna and the signals they receive and process were very much separate. But starting in at least in my experience, starting as early as the 1990s, this model began to change, and this is illustrated in slide 50. In slide 52. But before we come to slide 52, in slide 51, just to further illustrate the differences in these two information systems, I've set forth in some detail in tabular form the elements of these two systems. So, turning to slide 52, and as I just said, beginning as early as the 1990s, that historic separation of the two information systems here, the two information networks, the historic framework began to change as the SEC in certain instances purposely set up antenna around FDA reactions to data about clinical trials reported or not reported by companies who disclosures about those trials or lack thereof had materiality in the capital market setting. I remember distinctly prospectuses for IPOs that we were working on being sent by the examiner at the SEC over to the FDA to get the FDA's sense of what we were saying in those prospectuses about the progress that a company was or was not making with a particular drug and what we were saying about clinical trials. I remember that happening as early as the 90s, but it wasn't a formal program. It was informal, where the SEC would send something over to the FDA to take a look at. In 2004, this changed, and the what I would call the expansion of the SEC's antenna to FDA reactions to disclosures in SEC filings. That expansion was formalized in 2004, and this is illustrated in slide 53. As this slide shows, in 2004, in a pair of simultaneously issued press releases, each of the FDA and the SEC publicly announced a set of new measures to improve the manner by which the FDA assists the SEC with technical and scientific support in respect of SEC efforts to protect the integrity of the capital markets. And as these press releases indicate, what was also implemented at that time for the first time was a centralized procedure for FDA personnel to use in order to refer to the SEC statements by FDA-regulated firms that may be false or misleading. On slide 54, we can see the impact of this graphically using our antenna and signaling metaphor. In this slide, we see a new set of antenna around capital market disclosures providing signals to the FDA that can lead to further signals from the FDA to the SEC. This image in slide 54 depicts a regime of interagency communication and coordination. At least some commentators and professionals working in this area have discussed the possibility that these procedures that we just looked at, the description of which we just looked at in the press releases, that these procedures could evolve from procedures designed to promote interagency communication and coordination to a new system of integrated global compliance disclosure rules. This is illustrated in slide 55. My own sense is that in the wake of drug safety problems that dominated the news from 2004 through the signing into law of FDAA last year, efforts to spur this evolution, if any, were put on a slow track. So I'm not sure that what's suggested in this slide is actually going to happen anytime soon. A few moments ago I mentioned that when you get a fundamental inconsistency between what the FDA is actually doing with respect to your clinical trial result disclosures, when you get to an inconsistency between that and what you're saying about that in your own SEC file documents, you have a problem. And we're going to look at that now, and as a means of introducing it. Back in 2004, 2003, the SEC's Enforcement Division became very active in pursuing disclosures in financial market documents that the SEC deemed to be false or misleading. The SEC's office in Boston, which is a center of biotechnology companies, was particularly active in this regard. Slide 56 sets forth excerpts from a September 2004 article in the Boston Globe about this. In an article, as shown on the slide, in an article titled SEC Focusing on Drug Makers, Full Disclosure of Tests Called Key, the Globe reported three major aspects of the SEC's efforts here. First, the SEC was engaged in scrutinizing biotechnology companies. Note the reference to biotechnology companies, not pharmaceutical companies, to ensure that the companies don't mislead investors by covering up negative results of clinical trials. Second, the SEC was taking the view that representations about the status of a product in development can be very damaging to investors. And third, that the SEC was looking at whether biotech companies were disclosing the results of clinical trials in a timely fashion. One of the companies that came under attack by the SEC for these sorts of problems was BioPure Corporation, in connection with disclosures it had made about its Hemopure product. Hemopure is a hemoglobin glutamer product derived from cows for treating severe anemia in adult patients undergoing orthopedic surgery and for the elimination or reduction of red blood cell transfusions in these patients. The product at this point in time, 2003-2004, the product that had been approved for use in South Africa. I want to use the balance of this last hour of this last class to illustrate this case, as well as the tools by which you can research cases like this. This examination that we're about to engage in will provide some important lessons in counseling clients that are subject to securities laws about disclosure of clinical trial results, and it will also provide you with some important research skills and tools. So assume that you have been told that a company called BioPure had problems with the SEC regarding public disclosure of clinical trial results that it had reported in 2003. And that's all that you have in terms of information. You're obviously told that the company is a public company and reporting to the SEC. I think I said that. One of your first sites to visit when you're faced with a problem like this is to track down more information. And a good place to do this is always the SEC's EDGAR online database. And this database can be used for a lot more than just problems like this, but we'll look at it in this context. Slide 58 contains a screenshot of the SEC homepage. And note, it is around the middle of the page, just actually down at the bottom of the page in the lower left-hand corner. Note the caption, Filings and Forms, EDGAR in parenthetical. And the subcaption under the Filings and Forms caption that says Search for Company Filings. By the way, EDGAR stands for Electronic Data Gathering and Retrieval System. It was developed by the SEC back in the first part of the 1990s. If you click on the subcaption that says Search for Company Filings, you get to the EDGAR page, a screenshot of which is set forth on slide 59. Once you're on this page, there are many different things that you can do in EDGAR, one of which I'll note real quickly in the lower right-hand corner is a reference to XBRL submissions. This is the SEC's Semantic Web Technology program, and which I urge you to study in the coming months, because it really represents Semantic Web Technology. As I think I've mentioned in an earlier class, Semantic Web Technology will be as important to the next 20 years of using the internet as the World Wide Web has been to the last 20, but that's a subject for a different course. Let's come back to the matter at hand, and what we want to do is note the Companies and Other Filers tab, and we want to click on that to get to the filings of BioPure. And when you click on Companies and Other Filers, you're brought to the form that is shown on slide 60. Notice in this form that I had already that I typed in the word BioPure in the company name field, and I have also checked the exclude radio button to exclude a certain class of filings reporting relating to ownership of BioPure securities. With these two things, filling in the name BioPure and checking the exclude box, you then hit the find companies command box, and that takes you to a listing of all of the subject company's filings. The term command box, by the way, is a technical term that goes to object-oriented computer programming, and what I probably should say is not the command box, but the link find companies. So when you click on this link, on the find companies link, you get the type of listing that's set forth on slide 61, 62, and 63, which is a listing of all of the filings of the company that you're searching. Note that this listing that I have here on slide 61, 62, and 63 is one that I generated last year at around this time. So the most current documents in this list date back to 2007, not 2008. In this listing on these three slides, if you go to the third slide, slide 63, you notice filings made in 2003, which is the period of time that we're interested in based on the facts that we're researching. And you see that in July of 2003, on July 2nd, the company filed an S3, an amended S3, a form S-3/A. Now, an S3 is the form that a company files for a securities offering if the company is already public and certain threshold conditions are satisfied. An S3 filing, generally speaking, is simpler than an S1 filing. Form S1 is the form used for companies making an initial public offering or that otherwise don't meet the threshold tests in Form S3. By clicking on this July 2nd, 2003 filing, you are provided with the page shown on slide 64. And by further clicking on the S3A link on this page, you are taken into the filing. Slides 65 through 71 contain excerpts from the company's form S3A. And when we look at slide 65, we see the facing sheet of the S3A filing here that was made on July 2nd, 2003. Now, a filing on Form S3 and also S1, Form S1, typically contains the form of the prospectus that the filer intends to use to raise funds through the public sale of securities. In this case, we see on slide 66 the cover of the BioPure prospectus contained in the S3A that we're looking at here. We see that this prospectus related to the offering of shares of common stock of the company and warrants to purchase shares of common stock. A warrant is the right to purchase a security at a given price during a specified period of time. Like most prospectuses, this one that we're looking at contained the risk factors section. Note that the very first risk factor in the company risks section on slide 67 is that the company had been told by its independent auditors that it may not have been able to continue as a going concern due to insufficient funds. The filing was made in July 2003, and the risk factor says the company would likely run out of funds by October 31, 2003, 4 months of cash, in other words, is all that the company had left. This was obviously not a happy situation in which to find yourself if you were an investor, director, officer, employee, or creditor of the company. Another important risk factor is the one about the potential for failure to obtain FDA approval of the company's HemoPure product. note the company's disclosure about this in its risk factors section in the prospectus we're looking at here on slide 69. And I'll just read from that risk factor for a moment because it really captures the flavor best to do so. We have filed an application for approval with the FDA, and the application was accepted for review on October 1st, 2002. The FDA has advised that it will have completed its review and take action on the application by August 29th, 2003. We believe that our completed pivotal Phase 3 clinical trials are consistent with the FDA's most recent guidance on the design and efficacy and safety endpoints required for approval of products such as HemoPure for use in surgical indications. However, the FDA could change its view, require a change in study design, or require additional data or even further clinical trials prior, and I'm excerpting here, prior to approval of HemoPure. Recalling what we have learned previously in the course, as a blood substitute product derived from cows, HemoPure is a biologic requiring FDA approval of a biologic license application, a BLA, for the manufacture of the product before it can be marketed in the U.S. As a minor deviation from the main plot here, note that one of the ways that an S3 filing for securities offering allows you to simplify the process is through incorporating into the prospectus by reference for the offering other filings that you have made with the SEC. We see that process at work on slide 71. Note that among the documents, the other disclosure documents incorporated by reference into this prospectus was the company's reports on Form 10-K for the year ended October 31, 2002, and on Form 10-Q for the quarters ended July 31st, 2003 and April 30th, 2003, as well as a few other current reports that the company had filed during 2003, and the a description of its preferred stock purchase rights dating all the way back to 1999. To access any of these filings incorporated by reference into the prospectus from the listing of documents filed by the company, you follow the links to the applicable filing. Excerpts from the Form 10-Q filed for the quarter ended April 30, 2003 is set forth in slides 72 and 73, and excerpts from the Form 10-K are set forth on slides 74 and 75. Turning back to the main plot, you should notice in the listing of documents filed by BioPure a current report on Form 8-K filed on August 1st, 2003. A month after the S3 was filed, the S3A was filed for the offering of common stock and warrants. Current reports, as I mentioned a few moments ago, cover information that is so material that its disclosure cannot wait for the next quarterly or annual report. Current reports on Form 8-K often speak to events that companies also cover in press releases. The August 1st, 2003 8-K filed by BioPure is an example of this. In its August 1st, 2003 press release that I have set forth on slide 77, BioPure announced that the FDA had notified the company that the FDA had completed its review of the HemoPure BLA and had issued a letter requesting the company to provide additional information and clarification of clinical and preclinical data and commenting on labeling. The company also noted that the FDA had not requested additional clinical trials, and it was encouraged that the FDA had finished its review in advance of the formal action due date. The company stated that it would work with FDA to address the remaining questions and will provide its answers as expeditiously as possible. So, with these sorts of disclosures, you can get a sense that even though the SEC was raising additional questions, the company had it under control and was going to work with the FDA and was going to eventually get approval. But things didn't work out that way. And in 2005, all of this came crashing down on BioPure and its top three officers when the SEC brought an enforcement action against the company and those officers. Excerpts from the cover page of this litigation are set forth on page 78 and slide 78 and on slide 79 through 82, there are excerpts from the government's complaint, and in the interest of time, I'll let you read that offline. But when you read through this, you get a very different sense of what was happening at the FDA with respect to the company's BLA than what the company had disclosed in its S3A and other SEC filings. In short, the SEC alleged that during the period of 2003 that we were just looking at, in the company's filings with the SEC, the company had misled investors about what was actually happening at the FDA in respect of the company's BLA for Hemopure. This led the SEC to charge that the company had violated the basic rule against false or misleading statements under the U.S. federal securities laws. This rule is set forth, or one of the most important of these rules is set forth as Rule 10b-5 in the rules that the SEC has promulgated under Section 10b of the Securities Exchange Act of 1934. I have included Section 10b on slide 82 for your convenience. Now, as indicated at the bottom of slide 82, the defendants in this action settled with the SEC and agreed to an injunction against future violations. That's. I hope that what we just went through was fairly sobering. It was certainly intended to be, and it certainly sobers me. The Hemopure story continued after the litigation was settled, and Hemopure, the company, continues in existence today. You should check out their website to get a sense of where they are. An interesting post-litigation event of which we should take note is illustrated in slides 83 and 84. These slides speak to the imposition by the FDA of a clinical hold on a clinical trial of Hemopure. Remember clinical holds from when we looked at INDs many, many weeks ago. So the decision by the FDA to impose the clinical hold on the clinical trial being proposed by Hemopure here was based on findings by the FDA's Blood Products Advisory Committee in December 2006. Slides 85, 86, and 87 contain information about this meeting. Advisory committees are made up of experts outside the FDA to which the FDA looks for guidance in situations like this and others. It's interesting to note that one of the briefings made to the advisory committee was from the Naval Medical Research Center. Clearly, hemoglobin replacement products are important to the Navy and other branches of the military. This point really speaks volumes to the role of the U.S. military in the discovery and development of drugs, biologics, and devices that has played out over the course of U.S. history. You know, it's interesting to note as a sidebar here that stents, so many of us have relatives who have stents placed in their hearts. The technology that led to modern-day stents, really, the research for that began during World War II when the military needed a technology to replace arteries and veins that had been destroyed through war-borne wounds. And I guess the role of the military here harkens all the way back to the U.S. Merchant Marine Hospital system that was first established in 1798 and which ultimately became the Public Health Service. You know, and there's a part of the Public Health Service that is like the military in the sense that they wear uniforms, and their uniforms look just like Navy uniforms. So with that said, this is probably a fitting place to end, having traversed a wonderful circle through the subject matter that we've been looking at. There are some remaining slides on the deck here in which several aspects of collaborations between and among entities and the globalization of the DDC pathway are set forth. But I'll leave these for you to explore, and I'll just say quickly that I've enjoyed very much spending the semester with each and every one of you. I appreciate your attentiveness and attendance at class each week. And I look very much forward to working with you on finalizing your papers, which in an email I indicated are just absolutely terrific. And I wish each of you much success. Thank you.